Last Word on Today FM.
Now, you're very welcome along. It is time for the Culture Club. I'm delighted to say we've got Ian Leslie with us. Ian has written one of the best review books of this year. It is John and Paul, A Love Story in Songs. Ian, welcome along to The Last Word.
Hi, good to be here.
Tell me about your love for the Beatles, because you know the Beatles have obviously been written about by many people. We're getting ready for a movie to come out. We're talking about musicals happening and being put together at the moment. 60 years on, their legacy from their very pomp is still probably as vibrant now as it was even back in the 1960s. Where did your love affair with the Beatles start, Ian?
Well, I was born in the 70s after they split up. But like a lot of people of my generation, I got into them because my parents had some of their records lying about the house, and I picked them up and started listening and went from there, really.
The book itself, you've obviously framed this around the friendship and probably the creative relationship between McCartney and Lennon, and that kind of intertwines throughout the book as well. Tell us about the decision to use the songs very prominently through this.
Well, I really wanted to read a book about the Beatles that treated the music as central to the story, because obviously that's why we're talking about them in the first place, but it was also really good on the relationships and the people. And I hadn't really come across one that satisfied me on both counts. So it just struck me that you can't write about the relationship unless you do it through the songs, because they bonded over this, over songs and songwriting, playing together, and their love of music, and put their feelings into these songs. So you can't really write about them. Certainly you can't write about them in any emotional depth unless you do so through music, because that's where their feelings were. The songs where they put their emotions, really. I thought, well, you know, let's tell the story from when they meet in 1957, right all the way through the Beatles until John's death in 1980. But let's tell it through the songs.
They have quite a remarkable relationship in a lot of ways. So when they first meet, they're bonded in a way, I think, by, you know, a lot of common themes, you know, like where they're from, but also the fact that they both lost their mothers at a young age seems to be fairly central to the friendship that they struck up.
Yeah, so they meet when they're teenagers, and they're really kind of are bonded by this kind of shared obsession with this new kind of American music, rock and roll, and by love of music of all kinds, really. And they play with their guitars, they get together and start writing their own. And so it ends up being kind of their primary mode of interaction. It's really when they're at the most honest with each other is when they're playing together.
I remember watching the Peter Jackson documentary, which he eventually put through from all the archive footage that came out on Disney, I think at the tail end of COVID, and everything felt fairly strained. And this is where a relationship with the band was about to break down. But yet something that really stuck out for me was John Lennon turned around to Paul McCartney in the Get Back sessions at one point as well and saying, "It's almost like we're lovers, you and I."
Yeah, it's a very funny moment. And he kind of goes through a few of the songs. Oh, darling, don't let me down. And sort of says, "Hey, get back, you know, come on, it's almost like we're lovers." And they both kind of flick their hair and look slightly embarrassed and then move on quickly. But it sort of is funny, but also revealing, because I do think that there was a love affair. I don't think, and I don't argue in the book, that they were having a sexual relationship. But in every other sense, it was like a love affair, and indeed it was a kind of love affair. It was very intense. It was conflicted. It was full of jealousy. It was full of insecurity, and it was full of tenderness and affection too. And around that time, 1969, they really are coming apart, both the relationship is coming apart and the group is coming apart. And so the emotions get even more intense, and you can hear them in those songs that they make in that last year.
Is some of that insecurity coming from trying to be the main person within the band, trying to create the best possible outfit for the band? Because you, through the way that you weave the stories through this book, you know, point out how in many ways a song that's written by McCartney may well be in response to Lennon, or Lennon is writing something after sitting down and, say, watching McCartney with Eleanor Rigby. He goes out then and tries to almost outdo his friend next time around.
Yes, and right from the beginning, really, they kind of have the or subliminal dialogue in the songs, where they sometimes sing about their feelings about each other. There is this kind of competitive dynamic, which isn't really competition between themselves as songwriters. They're not trying to prove I'm a better songwriter than you, you're a worse songwriter than me. That's not the point. The point is, how can I do something that's as good or even better than the song you just came up with? Which is a slightly different kind of thing, because the competition is about the work. It's to do with the songs. It's not to do with them as individuals. And that's how you get this incredible ratchet effect, where they basically are constantly trying to do something better than what happened the last song they worked on.
Is that part of what makes the Beatles so good? When you think, right, so we're nearly 70 years on now since the formation of the band. And if you were to go through a back catalogue that's put together in a decade or so, it would be hard if you were to bring someone to the music for the first time and say, have a listen to some of these pop hits from the late 50s, early 60s, and then maybe listen to the White Album and see what a difference there is creatively on that band in what is like a relatively short period of time where they continue to reinvent themselves.
There's no comparable phenomenon in music or even art more broadly that I can think of where you get such a rapid evolution of artistic personality and at the same time a very high standard. So it's not like they go from being very bad to very good. I mean, they did that earlier in their career before they got famous. They're doing great pop music in 1963, 64, 65. And then they transition into something else, a new form. So it happens at great speed. So they're on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1964 playing I Want to Hold Your Hand, and it's a huge hit. And then 2 years later, they're doing Tomorrow Never Knows, this just crazy like LSD trip in music without a melody. And we can look at the pathway from one to the other, but it's actually very hard to explain how they get there.
Yeah. Before we get into your, because naturally enough, the Beatles are going to come up in your picks now in a second, but just one last one I want to ask you about Lennon and McCartney is something you picked up on, which is by the mid-1960s, around 1967, we probably get to a point where Lennon and McCartney are almost entirely in sync at that point creatively.
Yeah, I'd say they were almost merging at points in 1967, and they become very, very... They spent a lot of time together, even more than they had done the last couple of years, and on Sgt. Pepper. And there's a lot of collaboration on the songs and also just a lot of hanging out together, occasionally doing an LSD together. And you can hear some of that intimacy as they explore the outer reaches of their musical personality.
No great surprise you've picked the Beatles as your favourite band here, given we've been talking with them for the last few minutes. But before I play a bit of music from it, tell me what you love about Abbey Road in particular, because most Beatle fans find it quite difficult to actually nail down what their favourite album is. So why have you gone for the iconic Abbey Road?
It's very rare that you get a band making amazing music, the best music of its career or some of it at the end of its career. You know, most bands go through a kind of decline. They're actually still, I think, improving in when they split up. Abbey Road is the last one they record, and but they know they're splitting up as well. So there's a kind of finality to it. Famously, it ends with a track which is called The End, and there's something incredibly poignant and sad about that they are going out full of creative fire and juice and joy, and at the same time this is undertow of sadness and poignancy, because they're winding this thing up. I mean, they may not have known, I think they did think, well, maybe we'll do another one, but I think in their souls they kind of knew. You can hear the intensity of that emotion, those conflicting emotions in the music. The other point about it is that they got incredibly good at playing together by that stage. I mean, they were already, all the way through their years of fame, they've been really good as a band, right? They had so much practice in Liverpool and Hamburg. But they get better throughout the 60s. And the playing on Abbey Road, just, you know, Paul's bass and George's guitar and John's guitar, and they're harmonizing and they're singing, their ensemble playing, Billy Preston is around as well. it's incredible. You know, everything about that, the playing and the production of that record is amazing. So, yeah, it's supreme.
Let's talk about a couple of songs from it then. First of all, Come Together. Beautiful blend that comes through that you were talking about, Ian, just a few moments ago. The other song that we've picked out from that album as well, which you'll have listened to in a second, is I Want You, which is probably known as She's So Heavy, probably by most people as well. So what appeals to you about this song?
Just the kind of radical oddness of it, you know, which is very kind of Lennon-esque thing, where he just strips... His, you know, he's got this incredible linguistic ability and loves words, and then he just does a song where it's just I want you, she's so heavy, pretty much. It's like I love the kind of the boldness and the craziness of that, and again I love the playing. The groove is incredible. The interaction between the bass and drums, Paul and Ringo just doing incredible things. And it sounds like Come Together and some of the other songs on the album. It doesn't sound like the last song of an exhausted group, and it doesn't sound like the last song of the 60s either. It sounds like the first song of the 70s, you know.
Yeah.
And it, Abbey Road to me feels like the opening up of a new era, and it's almost like they're looking forward, not backwards. It's just a really impressive achievement.
Let's have a listen. Listen to the Culture Club. Ian Leslie is here with me. Ian is also going to be in Dublin next month as well, in conversation with Tom Dunn and Paul Howard, two of the biggest Beatles fans that I know. That's going to be Wednesday, the 9th of July, 8 p.m. at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary. And you can pick up your tickets, pavilionthatre.ie. We'll be talking about some of Ian's other picks on the Culture Club when we come back after this very short break. Now, you're very welcome back to the Culture Club. Ian Leslie is with me. He has written the book on McCartney and Lennon. It is John and Paul, A Love Story in Songs. And he's also going to be coming across to Dublin next month as well on the 9th of July for a chat with Tom Dunn and Paul Howard. It'll be at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary. Tickets available now, pavilionthatre.ie. Ian, the first song you bought wasn't the Beatles. So tell me, what was the first record you ever purchased?
Well, I think it was... record by Adam and the Ants called Prince Charming, and they were like a very popular post-punk band, I suppose you'd call them now. I didn't know what they were at the time, but they looked amazing. He had face paint and they dressed like mad sort of 18th century soldiers. I don't know what they looked like really. And I didn't really understand the songs, but they were kind of cool.
Let's have a listen. This is Prince Charming by Adam and the Ants. Stuart Leslie Goddard, better known as Adam Ant, which is his real name. Tell me about the best gig you've ever been to, because as you mentioned, you were born a little bit too late to get to see the Beatles in person before they broke up. So what's your best ever gig you've been to?
I'm not really a gig goer. I mean, I have been to quite a few, I suppose, over the years, but I don't actually go to that many live gigs. And I really like records and, you know, recorded music. And I'm often a little bit, like, not that impressed when I go and see artists, groups live. But I love going to classical music gigs. I'm really into classical music. And I went to see a few years ago, I went to see Simon Rattle conduct, I think it was the London Symphony Orchestra and Chorus at Royal Albert Hall in Mahler's Second Symphony. And if you don't know it, it's an incredible work that if you ever get the chance to go and see it live, it's just absolutely massive, masses of people on stage and a huge emotional sweeping story that gets told through the music. And that I just thought was just, I could listen to that on a record and it would be great, but it was nothing like the live performance, which is just absolutely all consuming and blows you away. So yeah. I'm going to put that as my favourite gig.
Yeah, look, people will recognise the tune straight away. This is Mahler's Second Symphony. This is as performed at the BBC Proms back in 2011. Have a listen. I think the thing about going to a concert hall as well, Ian, is that you kind of can get sucked into that performance and the excitement of the sound reverberating around the crowd as well, and you can appreciate it maybe in a different way in person too.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, and it is well, like with any music as well, there's a visual dimension to it as well. So yeah, it's both oral. You can hear it, you can feel it. And you can see it just in this case, you know, seeing this huge orchestra do all these incredible things and seeing the conductor kind of being the center and the focal point for everyone. That's an incredible thing to witness.
I'm rewatching The Sopranos at the moment. I think it's 18 years on since the final episode kind of divided opinion about the way that they finished everything out. But I'm glad you've picked a mob movie as your favorite movie, because Goodfellas and The Godfather gets referenced a million times during The Sopranos too. So you've picked Goodfellas. Of all the Scorsese movies, of all the mob movies, what attracted you to Goodfellas as your favorite?
I don't know. It's just the one I have probably seen most often, and the one that's kind of most imprinted on my memory for whatever reason. But it is just where his like incredible visual panache and style meets his storytelling, and you know, the characters and the people in it are really, and the performances are really compelling. So sometimes you can watch a Scorsese film and it's very, very flashy. There's not much substance to it, but you really feel like there's a real human character at the heart of this one, and the story is really well told, and there's magnificent set pieces. So it's emotionally satisfying. It's full of visual pyrotechnics. It's dazzling. Some of the music is incredible.
That flash without substance could well be describing The Wolf of Wall Street, and maybe Scorsese will say that was entirely the point. But Goodfellas, 1990. This scene, which we're going to play a clip from here, is Henry Hill, played by Ray Liotta, and Joe Pesci, who was just incredible during that movie as well. You've also got him going to Paulie. So this is Henry going to talk to Paulie. Clip from Goodfellas. Have a listen.
You know, I can be trusted now, Paulie. I'm clean. On my kids, I'm clean.
You looked in my eyes, you lied to me. You treated me like a fucking jerk. Like I was never nothing to you.
Paulie, after what you said, I couldn't come to you. You know, I was ashamed. No, I'm ashamed now. But I got nowhere else to go, Paulie. You're all I've got, and I really, really need your help.
I really do. Take this. Now I gotta turn my back.
$3,200. That's what he gave me. $3,200 for a lifetime. Wasn't even enough to pay for the coffin.
Henry Hill, played by Ray Liotta there, the lead character in Goodfellas, at a point where he's basically working out what his next plan in life is going to be. Let's chat about your favourite play then, Ian, because this one, it's a musical, which I was in school way back in the days. So many catchy tunes in this one. Whether you're a Mastin fan, whether you're a Detroit fan, you've gone with Guys and Dolls.
Yeah, I mean, this is almost exclusively down to one production of it that I saw 2 or 3 years ago at the Bridge Theatre in London, directed by Nicholas Heitner, which ran for a long time. Will probably come back, actually, because it was so successful. And it was just one of the most incredibly fun theatrical experiences I've ever had. I didn't know the musical up until then, but it was such a funny script, and the songs are so great that any production of it would be fun.
Yeah, so the clip I'm going to play from here is a Broadway cast recording of it from the early 1990s. And this is the iconic song from the middle of it, Luck Be a Lady.
Luck be a lady tonight. Luck be a lady tonight. Luck, if you've ever been a lady to begin with. Luck be a lady tonight.
Luck, let a gentleman see.
Luck, let a gentleman see.
How nice a dame you can be.
How nice a dame you can be.
I know the luck way you've treated other guys you've been
lady
with.
Luck, be a lady with me.
A lady wouldn't flirt with strangers. She'd have a heart, she'd have a soul. A lady wouldn't make little snake eyes at me when I bet my life on this roll. So let's keep the party polite.
So let's keep the party polite.
Never get out of my sight.
Never get out of my sight.
Stick with me, baby, I'm the fellow you came in with.
Yeah, when I hear that, I kind of think of Marlon Brando, and I think of Sinatra from the kind of previous era, but it's one of those musicals that has endured through the years as well. The last few that we're going through, Ian, tell us about your favourite book, what you've picked here.
Suitable Boy by Vikram Seth. It's from the early 2000s, I think, but it's a real sort of modern classic, and it's almost like a kind of 19th century English novel, but set in India after the Second World War in the wake of Indian independence. And so it's a marriage plot, right? So it's about a girl, you know, about a family trying to arrange a suitable marriage. But it's got this big cast of characters, and you get this sweeping sense of Indian society. It goes from the highest of high society right down to the rural poor who have absolutely nothing, and everything in between. So it's panoramic, it's been such a long time since I read a book, and I have felt so immersed in its world, and I really loved hanging out with all the characters in it. I really felt like I got to know them, and was sort of bereft when I get to the end of it. And you know, people talk about novels like that, but it's not often I really feel that experience, and I had that with A Suitable Boy. Love so it. Strongly recommended.
We always ask to pick a TV memory of the childhood or a TV love of the childhood, and something a little bit more modern that's caught your fancy in recent years. So let's go with the classic here. You've gone for the comedy Cheers.
Cheers, was just a part of my childhood, because we used to watch it with my mum and dad, my brother, and I think it was on Channel 4 or something, but we used to kind of just watch it most weeks together, and we all just used to find it amazingly funny. And Sam and Diane at the bar, and Norm, Woody. So these characters really kind of stick with you. And when I've gone back to it and I've watched it a few times, it's still good. Like it's not something that's really dated. It's just amazingly well written and very lovable comedy.
Yeah, first few times I started to watch it, I went bizarrely back to front. Frasier made me want to go and see Cheers. So that was the way I kind of got into Cheers first, and Cheers still holds up brilliantly, brilliantly well. The more recent one is something that I've been waiting to watch a while, so you can tell me why I should be watching this and not skipping the ads for it when it comes up on streaming services. Would I Lie to You is what you've picked here.
Yeah, and I chose it because it's the same kind of experience, but for my new family, I suppose, you know, with my, it's a show called Would I Lie to You? It's a game show. Mm. And the hosted by Rob Brydon. It's an absolute kind of genius of TV. Every episode of it is funny, in a very kind of clever, but very broad way at the same time. And I watch it with my kids now, who are 10 and 12, and my wife, and it's one of the few things that we kind of, you know, do together in terms of TV, and so it's a lovely kind of counterpoint to Cheers, and I hope that they'll kind of grow up remembering that as in the way that I fondly remember watching Cheers with my family.
I keep seeing ads for it, and it's probably because I'm a massive Peep Show fan, and I'm sure David Mitchell is coming up in the algorithm. I like all the comedians involved. I haven't watched it yet, so you've given me a very good reason to actually sit down and watch a few episodes. And we always finish off by picking a buried treasure. So tell us, why is Prefab Sprout your buried treasure?
I think other than the Beatles, maybe Prefab Sprout is my sort of personal connection with a band. I mean, the Beatles is owned kind of by everybody, which is part of why we love them. But Prefab Sprout, relatively sort of niche interest, I suppose. But I got into them in the 80s when they were first around, so late 80s. It's very emotional, it's very clever, very odd, angular, often, but also with these beautiful melodies at the heart of them as well. And the album Steve McQueen, probably the best album, although I think there's two or three albums which are contenders for that title. But it's got When Love Breaks Down on it, which is one of their kind of best known songs and one of the kind of easiest ways into them. But I was just really captivated by this combination of kind of literacy and cleverness and intelligence and big emotions and big ideas and big tunes. Often, you know, the verses will be quite clever and kind of weird, and then it'll just hit you with this huge chorus. And a lot of emotions. So I really think they're a wonderful band. And Steve McQueen is everybody should know that album.
Yeah, you've been listening to Ian Leslie on The Culture Club. His book is out at the moment, John and Paul, A Love Story in Songs, comes very, very strongly recommended. Ian, thanks a million for joining us on The Culture Club. The Last Word on Today FM.